It is 8:30, and we have with us in the studios once again Bob Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Morning.
Is it still foggy out?
More or less.
More or less.
A little bit.
Okay. Seeing if the weather matched what's going on in my head.
Having a good Friday night, huh?
No. No. Part of the problem. All right. So jumping into this week's news, I'm elated to hear that there's some more tax cuts on the horizon.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Congress passed its fourth tax cut bill in 4 years. It's been billed as the middle class tax cut, which I'm sorry, that always makes me laugh whenever I have to say that, the middle class tax cut. We were just coming up with alternative names here, and I think my favorite is the we don't want a middle class tax cut. And I just want to go over with folks what about this tax cut is particularly bad. For one thing, two-thirds of the legislation's benefits will go to the richest 20% of households, and only 10% of the benefits will go to what might be considered the true middle class, folks who are exactly in the middle. It's going to be funded with deficit spending, adding some $146 billion to an already record-setting deficit estimated to be at $422 billion by the end of this year. Now, that means it's going to have to be paid for down the road sometime in the future.
Sometime, with somebody's kids.
Yeah, meaning it could be 10 years in the future, which means we'll have to pay for it, or it could be, 20 or 30 years in the future, which means our kids will be paying for it.
And the interest on it, too.
And some of the ways that it will be paid for includes an increase in taxes is one option. Or cuts in social spending, that's another option. Or cuts in funds to state and local governments, that's a third option. Of course, it's probably going to be a combination of all three of those. Now, I want to talk about why, in particular, cuts in social spending and cuts in funds to state and local governments are particularly bad. Now, some folks might think, oh, that's not so bad, cuts in government, that's a good thing. Well, there's a problem with that. If there are cuts in funds to state and local governments, for example, you get tax increases on the state and local level in order to pay for services. For example, we're looking at here in Washington State a 1% sales tax increase to pay for school funding because there's no federal money coming for some of very necessary school programs. For example, the No Child Left Behind Act that was passed by Congress, there's been no funding from the feds in order to put any of those initiatives into practice.
Yeah, we've also seen, though, on the state and local level, additional cuts to social spending.
That's right.
To make
That's
up
right.
for the lack of federal funding.
Yeah, now there's a problem when there's a decrease in social spending all across the board. That negatively impacts all wage-earning Americans. It negatively impacts that. And you might be scratching your head saying, well, how does she figure that? It's very simple. When you take away the social safety net, you take away a key tool that American workers use in order to keep their wages increasing. In other words, if you are in a job where your wage is stagnating, you will be more likely to look around for a better paying job if there's some social safety net, some unemployment money, some money from the government to help you make your medical payments or pay for health insurance, etc. When those things are gone, you're more likely to stay in a job where the wages stagnate. And that's the main reason why the upper class really likes cuts in social spending. I mean, if you look at it from other perspectives, they could care less if there's social spending or not. But when you look at it as a fact that social spending allows wage earners to really push for better working conditions, for benefits on the job, and for higher wages, that's the main reason why the upper class really pushes for cuts in social spending. So when you have those cuts, it really, really impacts our ability to continue to earn a living wage.
So it literally keeps people in their place.
It does. It does.
Very much so.
Now, I should also add here that George Bush and the Republicans ignored a drive by certain liberal Democrats for the tax cuts to be paid for by closing a number of corporate tax loopholes. So that really gives you a good idea that this is a tax cut for the rich, not a tax cut for the middle class.
Yeah, that is to say, pieces of the tax code that were already designed for upper classes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're at a point now with corporate income taxes where at the state and federal level they pay for very, very little compared to the individual income tax.
And at the federal level, corporate taxes have been decreasing over the last 5 years, actually over a much longer period. It's been a long, slow decrease in the amount of taxes that corporations pay. And some of the wealthiest corporations in the Fortune 500 pay almost no tax. A few of them pay none at all.
So the timing on this tax cut appears to be a benefit to the White House.
Yeah. And Congress made a big push to get it passed before the elections. The Republicans really pushed for it, and a surprisingly large number of Democrats voted for the tax cut, too. But they did it for strategic reasons. They basically said, well, I'm voting for this because it would look bad for the Democratic Party to vote down a tax cut in an election year. It's basically what they said.
Yeah. And you have also, with the situation Oh, I lost my train of thought entirely. Never mind.
Moving along.
It'll come back to me in about 5 minutes.
Just jump in whenever.
Yeah.
It sounds like things aren't adding up at Fannie Mae.
No. In fact, a little less than a year ago, we talked about problems at Freddie Mac, one of the big federal home loan mortgage corporations. Now, I'm just going to explain briefly. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are two companies that were chartered by Congress in order to provide mortgage assistance to low-income homeowners. Now, those companies were chartered by Congress, but they have private shareholders, so they're run as for-profit companies. Now, like a lot of for-profit companies that have gotten into trouble in the past 3 or 4 years, like Enron and WorldCom, etc., they put into place these compensation packages that gave their CEOs and their upper-level management, gave them the incentive to do all kinds of sort of iffy accounting tricks, some of them considered illegal accounting tricks, in order to make their books look a little bit better so that they could get paid more money because the share price or the share's earnings of the stock of the company had a continuous increase, would have a continuous increase over time. So their compensation was tied to the amount of earnings per share of the corporation. Now, in order to keep the earnings per share rising, they did all kinds of things, juggling expenses, moving them from 1 year to the next, etc., and juggling their income around to make it look like they had a steady profit when, in fact, they don't and didn't. And now that the regulators are catching up with them, they caught up first with Freddie Mac, the smaller of the two corporations, last year, and they ended up having to pay a large fine for having misstated their accounting for several years. And then the office, let's see, it was the Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight, which oversees both corporations, decided to take a review of Fannie Mae, the larger of the two corporations, and it's come up finally with a report that it issued that said, well, yes, there were problems at Freddie Mac, but the problems at Fannie Mae are much, much worse and much more extensive. So here you have the largest mortgage lender in the business, who is under review, is going to be under review by the SEC. They have finally jumped in and said, we're going to look at the problems and see what's going on here, because this is a major problem, particularly for the mortgage industry in general. So we're going to see how that unwinds. I warned last year when they were looking at Freddie Mac that Fannie Mae is operated in exactly the same way as Freddie Mac, and that the problems with Fannie Mae are going to be much bigger and have a much larger impact on the home mortgage market.
Yeah,
so we'll see where that goes.
Folks might be interested that there's a very good article in the business section of the New York Times this morning on that, and particularly on the original whistleblower in Fannie Mae, who is now out of a job and
he's actually been assisting with the review.
He's been assisting with the review, but he's basically, in terms of the secondary mortgage industry, a pariah at this point,
mm-hmm.
because nobody wants to hear from the messenger.
So, what's the difference between the two enterprises? Why create two, I guess?
It's a matter of focus and volume. I could go into that in detail, but we don't have a lot of time for that.
All right. Well, then, that takes us to international stuff, and I guess that's This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
Yes, Ayad Alawi, the interim prime minister of Iraq, visited the U.S. this week. Now, his main goal was to reassure Congress that and the American people that elections in Iraq will occur in January as planned. And, of course, he had another motive, which was to give George Bush a little push before the election here in the U.S. Now, Ayad Alawi made a couple of very disturbing statements this week. The first one is that elections can go forward in all but three of the provinces in Iraq. Now, in reality, at least six provinces and most of Iraq's major cities are experiencing violence that would severely limit their ability to hold free and fair elections. It would make it difficult, if not impossible, in, you could argue, more than half now of the country. And that includes Baghdad province and the city of Baghdad, where the neighborhood of Al-Sadr city, which holds 2.5 million people, roughly half the population of the capital city, would not be able to participate in the elections. The provinces of Anbar, Diyala, Salahuddin, Kirkuk, and Nineveh would have severe problems in even getting election monitors there, much less getting people to register folks to vote, etc. And there were several cities, Fallujah, Samarra, Bakuba, Ramadi. There'd be problems in Basra as well, and many cities in the south in holding elections right now.
And can I throw in, there's a class element to this, too, that in Sadr City and some of the other urban areas, the areas that are most thoroughly no-go zones for the Americans and for the Iraqi government are also some of the poorest areas in Iraq.
Yes.
So that for the ruling elites and the folks who are working with the Americans and the interim government are very much tied to some of the business and economic elites in Iraq. Not all, but some.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you look at...
They are just fine with the poor not being able to vote.
Yeah, if you look at who wants the elections to go forward as soon as possible. I mean, it's George Bush, for obvious reasons, so that his elections will go as planned here. Ayad Alawi, who is in power right now and really doesn't care if the poor in Iraq vote. And Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani wants the elections to go forward as soon as possible because, in his mind, he sees that the most peaceful areas in the country are Shiite-dominated, and that means the Shiites will win out big if elections go forward as planned in January, with most of the Sunni areas unable to participate, and problems also in some of the Kurdish-controlled regions or Kurdish-contested regions like Kirkuk. Now, another thing that Ayad Alawi said that was very alarming is that he said that the rise in the number and ferocity of terror attacks in Iraq, and he's talking about attacks against U.S. troops as well as car bombings against various offices of the Iraqi interim government. He said that the increase in those attacks was proof that the guerrillas were getting weaker, not stronger. Now, you can hear a statement like that and you can say, okay, the guy's either a moron or he's a liar. And I'm telling you, he's not a moron, that's for sure. Now, Bush, at the same time, gave his annual speech to the UN this week, and he asked for more troops for Iraq. Everybody, pretty much everybody who was able to drum up troops for Iraq laughed behind his back and said, there's no way. Nobody's going to send troops, nobody, including France, Germany, Belgium, Spain, Pakistan, Egypt, nobody's sending any more troops to Iraq to help out. In fact, a French newspaper said that Bush's speech, quote, showed that slightly autistic self-satisfaction remains the dominant tendency of American power, end quote. And it was very obvious.
I love that quote.
Yeah, don't you love that quote? Slightly autistic self-satisfaction, I think, describes George Bush very well. And they all pointed out every one of the media and the politicians from around the world who sat in and listened to his speech, they all pointed out that the speech was not being given to them. It was being given to the American people to help George Bush's election. Now, meanwhile, the U.S. military is preparing an offensive to conquer certain cities, particularly the cities of Ramada, Samarra, and Fallujah, and the Sadr City neighborhood of Baghdad by the end of this year, in order to try and prepare them or prepare the way for elections in January. At least that's their goal. But it all hinges on training enough Iraqi troops to do the real fighting. Presumably, U.S. forces will only be used to send in helicopter gunships and bunker buster bombs, which is often referred to as aerial support. Now, supposedly, when they're all done conquering these cities, which might be mostly destroyed when they're done.
Which is also an enterprise that's waiting until after the election in this country because of the carnage that it would inflict.
Yes, after the election here, but before the January elections there. So they're looking at a late November, December time frame. Now, when they're done, supposedly Iraqi police will be patrolling the streets of these cities, and we'll see if that happens. Now, there's a few problems with this scenario. This week, the Pentagon admitted that only 53,000 of 101,000 Iraqi police, army, and National Guard troops have undergone any training at all. Only 41% have weapons, only 25% have vehicles, and 28% have body armor. Only 18% have any radios or other communications equipment, including cell phones, in order to call for help if they get swamped or are in trouble. Now, a British Brigadier Nigel Aylwin Foster, the number two man responsible for training Iraqi security forces, told the French press agency this week that Iraqi security forces won't be fully armed and equipped until the end of 2005. That's the end of next year, not the end of this year. The army won't even have all its bulletproof vests until February, after the supposed elections were to occur. And the army has just 20,000 troops, which is not nearly enough to do the job alone. Now, daily bombings in Iraq, we hear about them, but you have to consider the target of these daily car bombings are the recruitment centers for the Iraqi army, the Iraqi police, and the Iraqi National Guard. That's cutting severely into the interim government's ability to recruit people to staff the Iraqi police and army. And NATO, which had volunteered or had under the U.S. whip, decided that they had better help train some Iraqi police in Iraq, have just this week decided on how they're gonna do that, how they're gonna actually do that and how many people they're gonna send. They're gonna send about 300 personnel. And none of those folks are from France, Germany, or Spain, the big contributors to NATO. So there's very low probability that there will be enough Iraqi troops well-armed enough in order to take back the cities of Ramadi, Bakuba, Samarra, Fallujah, and al-Sadr City in Baghdad.
When I was listening to some testimony last night of a hearing with Richard Armitage before, I'm not sure exactly which body it was, to tell you the truth, but it would have happened yesterday or the day before, and he was being questioned in by David Obie.
Oklahoma.
Yeah, thank you. And Obie had said, according to his numbers, that the coalition, the U.S. forces, had only drummed up about, it was like 23,000, 24,000 Iraqis, if you combine the police and the different things together. And Armitage actually said, yeah, I agree with your numbers there.
Wow. So he was including the police and the National Guard. And that's interesting.
So that's far fewer than...
Because Donald Rumsfeld has been caught several times greatly overestimating the number of Iraqi security forces. He was saying it was 200,000, and then he was saying it was 100,000, and then he was saying it was somewhat shy of 100,000.
Somewhat.
So I would guess around 23,000 to 25,000 is very shy of 100,000. And that's interesting, too, because they also don't tell you how many people have decided to quit their job and go home after they've gone through the training program and been under fire once or twice, or seen their buddies on the force blown up by car bombs, etc.
Or seen their neighbors on the other side of the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And decided not to shoot at them.
That's right.
All right, so Anything else on that?
No, let's go ahead. Let's go forward.
The other thing I heard Armitage mention was that he had they'd been talking about U.S. troops getting further extensions, the ones that are serving there. Obi had asked him about that, and he said that Richard Myers had been in a closed-door session earlier that week talking with members of Congress about that exact concept.
Yeah.
So,
Jav's going to talk here in a minute about the draft rumors. I think we should point out that these extensions really are a form of the draft.
Yeah, very much so. Involuntary servitude for people who sign contracts saying that they would only be in theaters of combat for a certain length of time.
Mm-hmm.
And those contracts are now being violated. Yeah, I did want to mention, by the way, when we were talking about President Bush talking earlier this week, that we also had a ramping up in the rhetoric from John Kerry, finally, for a change, that he came out on Monday with a major speech in New York University saying basically that the president was disconnected from reality on Iraq, and then again in response Tuesday to the Bush speech at the UN, talking about Bush as being somebody who was basically had no credibility to lead the world, and he's right on all of these counts. So it was good. A lot of people were very heartened this week to see that Kerry had come out a little bit more fighting than he has in the past, and a little bit more clearly defined what he wants to do in Iraq. Now, what he wants to do in Iraq, in terms of getting allies and more involved, is probably somewhat delusional at this point. The point for that kind of activity would have been about 6 months ago. I don't know that it's that realistic at this point. But at least he is more clear-eyed, certainly, about what's happening on the ground in the field in Iraq than our commander-in-chief seems to be.
So in... Then jumping back to the draft, we'd heard that mentioned by at least a year back by people like John Conyers, who had proposed it as a way of equalizing things so that...
Right, and McDermott was a co-sponsor to one of those bills. There were a couple different bills that were introduced in Congress to reintroduce the draft. They never even got a hearing in the Republican-dominated Congress. They were both introduced by Democrats. As a way of equalizing the burden so that it didn't fall entirely on the poor and the poverty draft. That there's only one person in the entire 535-member Congress whose child is in the armed forces, and that tells you an awful lot about who is and isn't going into the armed forces these days. But that being said, those bills were going nowhere. There was a startup there was a call out put out in the Selective Service for volunteers to fill the Selective Service boards, but that was a regular part of the 20-year rotation that people had served in that capacity for 20 years and their terms expired last year, so that fueled the rumors somewhat. But the biggest thing that's fueling the rumors is simply the fact that The Pentagon is going to need warm bodies from somewhere at some point fairly soon, that they simply do not have enough personnel to do what apparently needs to be done in Iraq in order to have any kind of stability in the security situation. But for the near future, for at least probably the next year, there is nothing on the horizon. The White House, at least in the Bush White House, has said that they don't want a draft. Kerry has said that he doesn't want a draft. The Pentagon is saying that they don't want a draft, that the people that they need in the armed forces are highly trained specialists. They don't need general recruits to get basic training. They need people who can operate some of the specialized machinery and weaponry that they have now. So it really is somewhat disingenuous when you have some of the activist groups that are out there that are talking about giving conscientious objector training to high school students and some of the other programs that are underway out there. It's based on scare tactics. It's something that is certainly politically possible and militarily probably necessary in the longer term because of how long we're likely to be stuck in Iraq. You know, we don't have any major leaders right now talking about pulling out of Iraq entirely, which is what we really need to be doing. But we don't have anybody... that isn't giving any scenarios that doesn't mean we'll be in Iraq for the next 15 or 20 years even, or at least, you know, for a long time to come. Under that scenario, longer term, you would think that a draft is certainly possible, but not anytime soon.
Yeah, but who would go for a draft this close to November? I mean,
about after the election that it would be reinstated. But, you know, one of the major reasons for not having a draft, one of the major political reasons for not having a draft, is right now the campuses are very quiet on Iraq. Students really haven't gotten into the anti-war movement to any significant degree because it's somebody else's problem, because it doesn't directly affect them. You start putting them in the crosshairs of a draft, and the campuses will explode.
Can I weigh in on that for
sure?
Good?
At least go for it.
Right now, it looks like there's not going to be a draft anytime soon, but things could change very quickly. What I was just talking about with the inability to recruit and arm and train Iraqi security forces, that's going to be a problem down the road. And the fact that the U.S. is losing more and more territory in Iraq to the guerrillas, that's going to be a big problem down the road. And eventually, especially if George Bush doesn't win in November, I think that makes a draft more likely.
Why do you think it's more likely if he does not win?
Because the Bush administration is very heavily invested in the idea of not using a lot of troops in Iraq. They have been invested in that from the very beginning, before the war, that they can,
yeah,
that they can deal
whole
with
Rumsfeld
Iraq.
Hold off, yeah, doctrine. Right.
And George Bush has been four square behind him on that. So I think if George Bush loses, and John Kerry, who has a much clearer idea of what's, I think, much clearer idea and much more of an ability to actually say what's going on in Iraq, because he's not invested in Iraq succeeding or not, the U.S. mission in Iraq succeeding or not, he would be able to look at it and say, well, we got to get the troops from somewhere because this thing is just going down the toilet. So that could change very quickly.
All right. Well, I suspect it'll be a subject we'll be coming back to.
Oh, yeah.
So, just about out of time, but we got some events coming up this week, and one of them is happening tonight.
Yeah.
You guys are involved.
We have an Ethan State birthday party, an eighth anniversary. We're going into Volume 9. In fact, that's what this last issue was. So we're having an anniversary party for listeners and volunteers. It's happening at 4302 Meridian Drive. It's a dessert potluck,
Meridian,
I believe.
Meridian
Avenue North, that's right, in Wallingford. It's basically 43rd Meridian, the northeast corner, which is the home of our layout person and erstwhile business coordinator, Lance Scott. And folks are welcome. We can't hold more than about 30 or 40, so don't swamp the place, but you're certainly welcome to come. The time is 7 o'clock, I believe?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock.
Okay.
It's a dessert potluck if you want to bring a dessert
right.
to share.
Donations are requested.
Yeah.
And then happening this Wednesday at 7 o'clock will be a talk on peacemaking in Colombia by a couple members of the Peace Brigades, Eric Schwartz and Sarah Weintraub. That's happening at Central Lutheran Church, which is at 1710 11th Avenue. That's Wednesday. Thursday.
It's on Capitol Hill.
It's on Capitol Hill. Thank you. Thursday at 7 o'clock, there'll be a benefit for the Community Alliance for Global Justice, very good local organization, happening at the Seattle Labor Temple. And it's David Rovics and Dave Lipman will both be performing, both musicians.
Outstanding musicians, but I would add, too.
Very good. That's at Labor Temple's at 2800 First Avenue. And then finally, Friday, this coming Friday, Daniel Ellsberg, Medea Benjamin, and Norman Solomon will be speaking at University United Temple Methodist, which is at 43rd and 15th in the U District.
Yeah, that's a great lineup. I'm surprised they're in such a small venue.
That's actually, yeah, that can hold a lot of people.
Can it?
They can pack in 1,400 if they have to.
That's still pretty small. We should Seattle should be able to get, you know, more than 1,400 people to see those folks.
Key Arena. That's where we need to put them.
I think Key Arena is where Michael Moore is coming on October 17th, uh-huh, if I remember correctly. Anyway, that's Friday night, 7 o'clock, University United Temple Methodist. So there you have it.
Okay. Can I throw a quick plug in
if
also?
It's very quick.
Yeah, that I'm starting to appear on the morning show on KVI now. So that in the 7:30 hour on weekdays. So
every weekday?
Not every weekday. Once a week. But it doesn't. It isn't a specific day of the week, so I can't give that, unfortunately. But it was on Thursday this past week. But if people happen to hear that and want to give a call in, it would be great to get supportive calls every once in a while. Because otherwise, it's basically the former Rush Limbaugh station in town, very right wing.
Gotcha.
So,
so
a lot of fun.
Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors, Eat the State. Tell people quickly, where can they find Eat the State?
You can find it at bookstores and cafes and other places where you find free periodicals. We come out every other week or so with local and global news of interest and comics and humor and that kind of good thing as well. You can also find us on the web, www.eatthestate.org. And if you have comments or tips or you want to help volunteer, as many of us who help put out a paper are volunteers, you can come to our event tonight in Wallingford, or you can give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.